told them not to. It's more likely that they're not voting because they are subject to the same conditions that led me not to vote. The realisation that it's totally bloody pointless. That the crime of occupying an Apple store and redistributing its contents is nothing. Nothing compared to the larceny that took place to get those goods on the shelves. That torching a Nike town is no crime at all compared to the incessant immolation of the rights of the workers that made the goods within. The burning of the codes that means those that profit from the store do not give back to the society in which they flourish. Legal asterisk. I'm not suggesting that Apple literally pilfer and steal like a big, giant, glossy, artful dodger. More that the corporate world in its entirety is a kind of thief of more wholesome values such as sharing. Through the dominance of organisations like Apple, whose products I continually use, we are all robbed of something more valuable than the trinkets they provide. Furthermore, their exploitation of tax loopholes and policies of maximising tax avoidance opportunities, like most big firms, is a kind of social robbery. I don't feel inclined to rally youths to put an X in a box on a little ballot ticket, but on the doors of those who will be spared when the plague descends, for we are at a turning point. The exploitation has now reached a pitch where the disenfranchised and exploited can look to a culpable minority with vengeful eyes. This minority, though, cannot be defined by the colour of their skin, but by the colour of their god. Green. These worshippers of Mammon have, with their ascendance into privilege, marked themselves out from among us. To tell the multitudinous dispossessed to take the rage of the terraces and the streets mendaciously aimed by whopping propaganda and rovermere smears at society's most vulnerable and poorest and take aim at this most deserving target. The system that exploits us cannot function without us, without our labour, without our compliance, without our consent. If we want a society in which people with insufficient resources are given what they are owed, where are we to look for recompense? To other people who also have nothing? The weak? The dispossessed? People who have arrived here more recently than we have? Or ought we be looking to organisations that have abundance, excess, wealth? There is no great mystery to unravel. The solution is quite simple. We must spontaneously cooperate. We must immediately overcome our superficial differences of accent and lexicon and come together to organise society effectively. The capitalist system is not the result of our collective greed. It is the manifestation of the greed of a few and the manipulation of the many. A global superstructure has been established to ensure the continuation of the current hegemony. There are some ideas worth voting for. No party in any civilised nation will propose them because they are not there to represent us and to ensure that the necessary change to protect us and our planet happens, but to simply maintain the current system. Here are some ideas. I got them from a diverse group of activists, ecologists and economists, many of whom struck me as eccentric, but these ideas are more fair than the ones that currently govern our reality and are neatly guiding us to Armageddon. Obviously, our ultimate aim is to live in self-governing, fully autonomous, ecologically responsible, egalitarian communities where like-minded people or people with compatible cultures, because all our minds are ultimately alike, can live together without fucking around with what other people are up to. The organs, both ideological and practical, are already in place. We have accommodation, hospitals, transportation and communication networks. All we have to do is disband the corruption that skews them for the advancement of an elite. The global treaties and economic infrastructure that has benefited the 85 occupants of the bejewelled fun bus of privilege can be subverted for the benefit of us all. It's easy. All we have to do is agree that that is our intention. I asked lifelong anti-globalisation campaigner Helena Norberg Hodge what to do to change the world. Helena is mostly concerned with counter-development. This means providing practical opposition and alternatives to governments and big businesses continuing promotion of globalisation and the consolidation of corporate power. Helena is interested in people that are resisting those policies, demanding a re-regulation of trade and finance and establishing models of agriculture and distribution which don't contravene obvious ecological laws. In response to my plea for solutions, she promptly sent this list. 1. Rein in the power of big business by renegotiating trade treaties to insist that multinational corporations be place-based and accountable to nation-states, revoking the charters of any corporation with revenues larger than the smallest national GNP, scrapping the WTO and creating a WEO, World Environment Organization, controlling the private funding of political campaigns. Now, you might have got a bit bored while listening to that. You may have felt a feeling in your tummy of anxiety and a bit of psychological insecurity. I'm not allowed to read stuff about charters, your second critical voice may have said. I was rubbish at school. My brain did all that stuff and I ploughed on. All Helena's suggesting is that global trading institutions and regulations have been set up in partnership with massive companies, probably like those snidey bastards Monsanto, and as long as the rules or system remain as they are, rich organisations will get richer and poor people will get poorer. The last sentence talks about controlling the private funding of political campaigns. If you are an American, and why wouldn't you be, you have never been governed by a party that wasn't the most well-funded during the electoral campaign that placed it in power. Whether you voted for the red one or the blue one, the donkey or the elephant, the brown bloke or the pink bloke, what you got was the richest party in that election. Every single time. Now, I don't want to come over all cynical, but doesn't that imply that you could dispense with the entire democratic process and simply award power to the party with the most money in its campaign fund? Yes, it does. Maybe not always, just every single time in history so far. Given that power is granted to the party with the most money, do you think it's likely that the parties in power feel an obligation to represent the desires and needs of the organisations that give them that money? Yes, so do I. I'll give you an example of how I saw this unfold in real time recently. About a week ago, I was reading The Sun, a British tabloid newspaper that stimulates lower primal energy centres like fear, sexual desire, jealousy and mindless tribalism, when I encountered an inexplicably upbeat story about fracking, the process of extracting gas from deep in the earth to sell back to people as fuel. The process is controversial, and there are several brilliant documentaries that expertly demonstrate the numerous dangerous effects, poisoning, flammable water, cancer, the sort of negative consequences a child might guess at if you told them you were planning to explode your way into the Earth's core, extricate gas, and sell it. How can you even begin to claim to own that? On what basis can an energy corporation claim to own gas at the Earth's core? What's next? Are they going to claim they own our earwax and our uncried tears and start burrowing into our heads for a few shekels? Out of nowhere, one morning, probably a Thursday or a Wednesday, one of those days, The Sun, apropos of nothing, announced with twitching enthusiasm that fracking's great! A double-page spread extolling its virtues with a table-thumping condemnation of those who oppose it. There are massive demonstrations at a pilot site in Balcombe, West Sussex. They even had Sun staff dressed up in comedic Batman and Robin outfits joyously trivialising the issue to anyone who'd listen. That's odd, I thought. Why does The Sun, part of an international media conglomerate, support fracking? Is it just a general buccaneering fraternity of capitalists all helping each other out, or is there a more obvious correlation? I once visited WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he is forced to live for reasons I've never fully understood. In fact, the whole concept of embassies and treaties and conceptual distinctions of that nature seem balmy to me, that you can just say, "This building is in Ecuador," and everyone has to go, "Oh, okay," and pretend they're not standing in the middle of London. Or that truce in the middle of the First World War, where on Christmas Day, when the English and Germans stopped and played football, surely the realisation that it was a possibility made the war on Boxing Day particularly dispiriting. Unless, I suppose, you'd been fouled or had a goal disallowed, then you might think, "I'm glad I get the chance to spray you with machine gun fire, Jürgen. There's no way that was a penalty." If we can imagine there's a bit of Ecuador in London or a bit of peace in the middle of a war, then surely we can imagine a fairer world and decide to live in that. I asked Assange if he believed in conspiracies, or more pertinently, the conspiracy. That global politics is governed by a shady cabal who meet in a smoky, dim-lit room and cacklingly manipulate our destiny. He doesn't, which is remarkable given that he was answering me from internment in a pretend bit of Ecuador as the result of Swedish sexual assault charges that arose after he exposed war crimes in the Middle Eastern conflict. He said that he saw the status quo more as a marauding Mongol horde of capitalists with shared interests charging ferociously in the same direction, the direction of make as much money as possible with no other considerations. I disagree with Julian, but the point is moot. The result is the same. Also, all his opinions are somewhat stymied and robbed of efficacy as he's banged up in a dislocated lump of Latin America. It was a bizarre experience visiting him in there. Not least because I, as was the custom at the time, went to the powwow armed with a yoga teacher. I was hanging out with her a lot. I took her along to the MTV Movie Awards, which I was hosting, where at one point, perhaps the summit of my own personal Everest of Hollywood kookiness, she vetoed a joke from my opening monologue. It wasn't unspiritual or mean. I think it was about Jennifer Aniston. It was cut for time, like the monologue was saggy. I don't know if that makes it less weird. Tage, her name was, and she was a bloody good Kundalini yoga teacher, and the lessons and techniques definitely induced interesting states of mind. Most people would have left it at that, but with my tendency for extremism, I first became teacher's pet, and then, in a macabre switcheroo, made the teacher into my pet. I've already told you, I'm a sucker for a mystic costume. I'm like a wartime gal with a thing for uniforms swooning at a GI, and Tage's get-up was world-class. Kundalini practitioners dress entirely in white, why not? They also wear a turban, as the yogic practice they follow is derived from the Sikh faith. Tage was a lovely woman, and we became good friends. I learned a lot and had a good laugh. A fair amount of that fun may have been derived, I realise in retrospect, from the novel thrill of turning up at unexpected places with a yogi, like the MTV Movie Awards, or at the Ecuadorian Embassy. During the production of my, let's call it experimental, with the emphasis on the mental, TV show Brand X, surely the last punning derivation my surname can provide, the whole of Tage's yoga class, which consisted of about 100 people, was uprooted and placed each morning at the studio where the show was recorded. That's pretty mad, isn't it? We left the comfort, tranquility, sweet smells and fine foods of the purpose-built yoga centre to practice yoga in the functioning canteen of a TV production facility. Sometimes when you're famous, you can get away with being a lunatic, especially if you're like me and think the system is corrupt and rules have to be broken and conformity challenged. Before too long, you have a scenario where the teamsters who do all the heavy lifting on a TV show are confronted with the daily spectacle of 100 yoga devotees descending on their canteen. Anyway, whichever of us is right, me or Assange, doesn't matter, but it transpired after I joked about the Sun's fracking story on my online badly named news analysis show, The Trues, and asked viewers if they could help me understand why this extraneous display of mindless propaganda was printed, I received some interesting responses. Rupert Murdoch, who owns News UK, of which The Sun is a subsidiary, sits on the board of US energy giant Genie Oil and Gas, which specialises in shale gas. That is another nicer word for fracking. Shale gas sounds nice and natural, like a sea breeze, a gale made from shells. Who could object to that? Certainly not a regular reader of Murdoch's New York Post, which has run 20 positive fracking stories since 2011. The relationship between the Sun newspaper and UK government is well documented and criminal. The second of Helena's suggestions concerns our relationship with food production. 2. Relocalise food and farming by taxing food miles, removing subsidies and research for large-scale capital and energy-intensive agriculture, giving support to small, diversified organic production and to the growing number of young people who want to take up farming. This second suggestion's a bit easier for us to read and reiterates the difficulties we face when capitalism and its mechanics are inserted into the most fundamental and necessary aspects of our lives, like food. Helena explained to me that most countries import and export a worryingly similar quantity of the same commodity. America, for example, exports the same amount of beef as it imports each year, hundreds and millions of tons of it. If you must have beef, and I would suggest we're eating too much of it, at least eat the beef that's near you rather than sending that off to Japan or whatever while simultaneously getting some far-flung beef chopped up and whizzed over on a jumbo jet like Freddie Mercury prolonging a holiday romance. Especially as we face several ecological crises that are being exacerbated by this unnecessary bovine jet-setting. 1. Global warming, and 2. Depletion of fossil fuels. Everyone knows that, so why is a profligate and dangerous planet-wide trade system being perpetuated? Because we are living under a fundamentalist dogma. The only relevant question is, how do we make the most money? The answer to that is by abiding superfluous trade tariffs. If that structure exists, it can be subverted or replaced. The administrative structure that serves capitalism can be used to serve a new, sustainable, nutritional system. A recent UN survey concluded that the world's agricultural needs could be met by localised organic farming. Of course, the organisations that benefit from things being the way they are don't admit that. They'll tell you that industrialised, genetically modified, patented farming is the only way to feed the world, half of who are starving anyway, another example of the floundering, deceitful maintenance of the current order. Remember when you were a kid and you thought that your diet had to constitute meat, eggs, cheese, bread and milk? The food groups, all that. The people that established that nutritional template were the people that sold, wait for it, meat, eggs, cheese, bread and milk. They discovered which commodities were easiest to produce and transport on an industrial scale and then told us that those commodities were the commodities that we should be consuming. In a way, this revolution will be a doddle because it isn't so much about creating new systems, it's more about disregarding obsolete ones. The food industry in its present form is obsolete. A food industry is necessary, but we have to remove from the system all components that are superfluous. Flying beef around the world like a dead carved up rent boy because it serves the agenda of big businesses to the detriment of the planet and its people doesn't require the contemplation of a sociological or economic genius. We just have to stop doing it. The way to do that is by disempowering the organisations that benefit from things staying the way they are. If that can be done by democratic process, fine. If not, that's fine too. The only option that isn't fine is things remaining as they are. Helena told me that there are apples that are grown in Britain, flown to South Africa to be clean and waxed, then flown back here to be sold and eaten. That would be indulgent for the fruit at Kim and Kanye's wedding. It's happening to the apple in your lunchbox. The suggestion of revolution is not mad. That is mad. Imagine if we had locally supported, collectively organised agriculture where our apples were grown in, I don't know, Kent. And if you lived in Kent, you could buy and eat those apples in Kent. Then someone turned up and said, I've got a better idea. Let me take over your orchard and all orchards like it, fly their produce around the globe to be spruced up, and then we'll give them back to you. Sound like a plan? We'd tell them a fuck off, wouldn't we? Well, it has happened, and we didn't, because nobody explained it to us. The reason they don't explain this to us is because they know that if we find out the extraordinary lengths that they're going to fuck us over, we will overthrow the current system and replace it with something fair. That's why all this important stuff is made to seem inaccessible, boring and abstract. That is why our participation in politics has been sanded down into an impotent nub. Stick your X into this box and congratulate yourself on being free. It pisses me off. It makes me want to get together a gang of Toxteth's finest, of Broadwater Farm's most deadly, Belfast's most up for it, and raid Molotov's drinks cabinet and light up the Westminster sky. I understand why people loot shops. I understand why people in Thurrock, where I'm from, vote for knee-jerk Burks like UKIP. How the tendency to condemn vulnerable outsiders flares up. Why should people be claiming benefits? Why should people be coming over here for work, welfare, healthcare, whilst behind this concentration of innocence marched out like a veil, lined up to be jeered at in the shadow they cast, the real criminals conduct their masquerade. The sneering puppeteers yank the strings and blind us. Immigrants did not cause the financial crisis. Benefit cheats did not get multi-million dollar bonuses. Disability claimants did not knowingly fracture the planet's stability. The final point on Helena's list has broad ramifications and requires a huge change in the way institutions behave, but oddly, it's already in line with the way that most of us think. 3. Prioritise life over profit by rejecting GNP in favour of indicators that measure biodiversity, community coherence, personal well-being and other life-affirming criteria, radically reducing public spending on defence, granting legal rights to ecosystems and non-human species, rewriting educational curricula to meet community and environmental needs rather than the needs of industry. Right, there's quite a lot to think about in there. Prioritising life over profit is a good example of how the way our world is governed has moved out of alignment with our nature. That means our system has become aberrant. Edward Slingerland, the professor of ancient Chinese philosophy that explained the concept of Wu Wei, told me the story of an artisan in the Zhuangzi. This fella apparently carved bell stands for bells, obviously that were vital in ancient ceremonial rituals. These bell stands were evidently top drawer. Everyone was crazy about them. At this point in the story, I had to make a bit of a psychological leap back to ancient China, because where I'm from, people don't get that excited about bell stands. I was struggling to imagine a bell stand of any description, let alone one that would get me really jazzed up. I mean, it's not even the bell, which would, for me, be the obvious star of the story. That's the thing that gets rung. But there you go. I'm not a Stanford professor, so I'll just keep my mouth shut. Everyone was so enchanted by this bloke's bell stands that someone eventually asked him how he made them, the equivalent of a local news item where the man who makes David Beckham's boots is patronised about his needlework skills. Initially, the craftsman is vague about his methods, coy, you might say, but after a probing, he yields. "I meditate," he says, "until I forget my intentions and attachments, until I forget the credit I will get for making a good bell stand, the adulation, the money. Eventually I forget even myself. Then I go down to the forest in this focused, open state, and I look at trees until I see a tree that already has the bell stand in it. All I have to do then is remove the excess wood until all that remains is the bell stand." It was around this point in Edward's recital that I realised the tale was allegorical. He wasn't inexplicably giving me a highly specific and probably redundant lesson on ancient Oriental carpentry, but in fact describing how to materialise concepts from a higher realm. First, transcend the lower basic requirements of the animal self, hungers, desires. I suppose that's why most religions have fasting as a ritual, to see what lies on the other side of hunger, on the other side of these basic drives. Then look without prejudice at the nature of the challenge, in his case, trees, in our case, the machinery of global capitalism. Wait until the solution reveals itself, then remove what is surfeit, in his case, twigs, bark, leaves, in ours, anything that isn't in the service of justly catering for our common requirements. The story also reminds us of the need for this process to be peacefully undertaken. Sometimes when incensed by the rancid tide of injustice, the impulse is to attack. We must avoid this. We have learned that violence as a means is always unsuccessful. Chapter 8. I am an anarchista. Gandhi, an extremely efficient revolutionary, is perhaps most admired for his excellent deployment of non-violent protest. The ingenuity of non-violence is not immediately obvious to us, the inheritors of a world built upon martial means, but the principle is almost like mathematics. Authorities are trained to deal with a particular kind of conflict, violent conflict. By using violent means, you are entering the territory that they are best qualified to control. Also, by becoming violent, you are tuning into the frequency that you are trying to overcome, the frequency of violation, violence FM. "Be the change you wish to see in the world," said Gandhi. "If you want a non-violent world, you cannot use violence to achieve it." He also said, "In the end, the British will walk out, because 100,000 British cannot control 350 million Indians if those Indians refuse to cooperate. A small minority cannot control an uncooperative majority, so they must be distracted, divided, tyrannized, or anaesthetized into compliance." Gandhi dealt with the colonisation of nations by nations. We deal now with the colonisation of consciousness by corporations. I spoke to David Graeber, the anthropologist, economist, writer and Occupy Movement member. Typically I would write Occupy Movement leader, but they eschew such titles in the movement. David is an anarchist. I don't know much about anarchism. I only know about anarchy from graffiti, the Sex Pistols, and as a kind of slur or reprimand from my mum. "Is that what you want? It'd be anarchy." Well, according to David Graeber, there's more to anarchy than not tidying your bedroom, spitting, and having a Mohican. In fact, it isn't defiantly disorderly at all. It is a society that has no centralised power. David came round my house in East London during a torrential downpour to talk to me about revolution. It was properly raining. I stopped what I was doing to look out of the front door at the rain. One of those sudden outbursts of nature that serves as a deft reminder that even mighty structures like cities are temporary and nonsensical. It smashed its way down from the sky, all joyful and triumphant like ye faithful. David turned up whilst I was marvelling at it and half planning an arc, with his jacket pulled up over his head like when you play Batman. It was ridiculous. He was soaking. I had to get a towel and offer him clothes that he wouldn't take. I knew immediately that I'd like him. He just had one of those faces. I could see what he'd been like as a boy, probably always fenced off in the electric penitentiary of a too fast mind. His eyes are narrow, like a Japanese person or someone from the future in a film. He spoke pertinently, given the weather, like Rain Man, or like his voice was trying to become a synthesized burr, like Stephen Hawking's robot voice. There was a salad on the table, still packaged, from a Thai takeaway. "Can I have this?" said David, already unpacking it, like it was an energy coin in a computer game. Then he sat there, eating, all wet and content, with a towel round his head, like E.T. on his way back to his spaceship. "How's this bloke going to dream up a new economic system?" I wondered. David is most well known for his idea of debt cancellation. Personal debt cancellation used to be a common policy in ancient civilizations. Every 7 years, all debt was cancelled. The Bible refers to debt jubilees, where everyone's debt would be reset to zero. I think it's especially nice that it was called a jubilee, creating an even more euphoric sense of carnival. In Islam too, usury, credit at extortionate rates like wonga or whatever offer, is forbidden. So this bizarre-sounding notion has strong historic precedent. It is a mark of how far into materialism we have descended that it seems unfeasible in our world. David explained from beneath my towel that debt repayment has a powerful moral charge in our culture, that people feel ashamed about debt and guilty about non-payment. 75% of Americans are in debt, 40% owing more than $50,000, whilst an estimated 9 million British people are in serious debt. What David Graeber, the anarchist, is suggesting is that all personal debt, debt for normal people, is cancelled. Think about it. That means you. All your debt, cancelled. When David said it, I felt excited, like it was naughty, like it shouldn't be allowed. This is the feeling I still get when I start a car. "I shouldn't be doing this," I think, plunging down on the accelerator. The reality is, I shouldn't be. I'm a terrible driver. My conditioning kicked in when David Graeber, I say his name like Craig David, said that debt cancellation is a contemporary possibility. I nearly told him to shush and looked over my shoulder for a park keeper. Immediately, just by contemplating it, you feel like you're bunking off school. "We can't cancel debt, we'll get the cane." I thought about the ramifications. Well, obviously, the majority of people would be thrilled. Tuesday night, you go to bed with a credit card bill, mortgage and a bloody headache. Wednesday, you wake up with a spring in your step and a pound note in your pocket. What a touch. Obviously, this is not such good news for credit card companies and banks. Overnight, their entire operation has been irrevocably altered. Most of these companies are international too. So what would the impact be on global finances? I imagine a mainstream economist, and let me tell you off the bat, I've no fucking intention of asking one, would say this action would instigate financial meltdown. What Graeber says in response to this is that $700 billion was written off and trillions were lent to banks as the result of the 2008 financial crash. That sounds like a lot, but I can't get my head round economics. I'm not supposed to get my head round economics. None of us are. It's designed to be obtuse. Look at those fucking Nasdaq, FTSE, Dow Jones things. Sometimes I accidentally press a button on my phone and the screen is filled with the numerical babblings of these unknowable entities, and it's more baffling and mysterious than the Amharic cries that filled the Kensal Green Church. They speak in numerical tongues as they worship their invisible God. That instinctive feeling I had when I was a kid, I bet you had it too, when the financial report came on at the end of the news was, "This is bollocks!" That wasn't the result of innocence or ignorance. We were right. Since then, there has been an attempt to inculcate and obfuscate and dress it up in conferences, rolling on-screen graphics and supercilious posturing, but we were right. It is bollocks! How can we conceptualise $1 trillion? Merrill Lynch, J.P. Morgan and Lehman Brothers were all lent in excess of $1 trillion to get them through that crisis. That doesn't seem fair. Plus, they all have names like Coronation Street baddies. "Merrill Lynch and the Lehman Brothers have burnt down the Rovers," someone might say. "It were probably an insurance job." At this point, it's worth noting that the economy is not a real thing. It's a man-made system designed to serve us, an ideological machine. It has gone wrong and is tyrannising us. We won't tolerate that from a literal machine. If my vacuum cleaner went nuts and forced me to live in economic slavery, I wouldn't roll my eyes and say, oh well, and humbly do its bidding. I'd turn it off and fuck it out the window. When the reckless and greedy trading, lending and gambling of the financial industry led to the economic breakdown that, if not resolved, would have provoked social upheaval, possibly revolution, the governments of affected nations got together in a smoky, dim-lit room and decided to press reset on the economy. Aside from a few people carrying plants out of their offices in cardboard boxes, I don't remember there being many consequences at all. Just some people with plants looking confused by a revolving door. Oh, and 13.1 million American people had their homes foreclosed because their debt, it turns out, was real. It was only the debt within the financial sector that was imaginary. It was only the people who generated the crisis who got three magical wishes from an economic genie. There was no abracadabra for ordinary people. They just got abraca-fucked. So we are not discussing whether or not debt cancellation is a possibility. We know it is. We've seen it. They've done it. All we are discussing is who is it possible for? Them or us? I've just worked myself into a revolutionary fervour again. Every so often the fury injustice rises up in me and makes me want to smash something or burn something, but nothing in my immediate environment belongs to me, so I have to refrain. Unless, of course, we consider that the concept of property is preposterous, like a Native American chief, Grey Elk or one of them, who, when us lot, by us, I suppose I mean white Europeans, you might not be one, I hope you're not actually, sorry for unconsciously addressing this book to imperialists, turned up in their country with contracts were confounded. How can you own a river? The river is our brother. Yeah, all right, mate, sign this, will ya? Here's some blankets for your trouble. We are so acclimatized to our metaphors that we no longer see them as imaginary or symbolic. We forget that most things that define us are conceptual. Most things that we consider real are the material manifestation of an idea. The laptop upon which I typed this book, once an idea in some boffin's noggin. The words that I typed, a consensual code of Saxon and Latin. My merrily dancing fingers, the result of an unrealized uteral form tracking some invisible plan towards realization. 4 o'clock on Wednesday. Just a concept, an agreement. Not actual, not real, like an apple or a heartbeat. Karate. Just a system of breath and movement. My support of West Ham United FC is a totemic symbol. Since I started supporting them when I was born, a hereditary legacy like my eyebrows or my addiction, they had different players, different owners, a different kit. Soon they will move to a different stadium. They play now in a different league, in a different way, under a different manager. What then is the West Ham that I support? It is the West Ham that my dad supports, that everyone at my school supported, that everyone at Upton Park supports. Those men terrified me on my early visits and still, if I'm honest, unnerve me a bit now with their tribal roars and curses, with their tears and vows, with their beers and rows, the chanting, the defiance, each of them, each of us. Us, there's the word, knowing that the game as we know it is dying, that the fraction of the club that belongs to us is being ever eroded. The concept of belonging, commodified like all else, their belief versus our belief, the song so root one, evocative and plain, West Ham till I die, I'm forever blowing bubbles, West Ham's claret and blue army, anthems of place and unity, folk codes of pride and togetherness, pride in both senses, honour and togetherness, ring-fenced emotion permitted only at 3 o'clock for 90 minutes in the stadium. Can we march that pride out of the gates and into the streets? Can we harness it, direct it, use it for something less stymied by white lines and whistles that could pour from the terraces and into the oak and leather chambers, the steel and glass towers? Money and the economy are just symbols, ideas, tools. If they don't serve us, if they don't serve the planet, then they have to change. They are not serving us or the planet, so why are they not changing? Where is the resistance coming from? It must be benefiting somebody. It's probably the occupants of the bejeweled bus. They seem to be behind all this mayhem. Of course, if we suggest alternatives that inconvenience them, they'll say it's impossible, implausible, sixth form, naive, Nazi. They'll say anything to prevent the realisation that change is necessary and inevitable. David said that secretly, even those that benefit most from capitalism know its demise is imminent. What they are preparing for now is what follows it. something fairer, or the militaristic maintenance of a comparable tyranny? I think given the evidence of history, it's obvious they'll favour the latter. Is there evidence that those in authority are preparing to confront mass uprising? David, as an anarchist, is opposed to centralised power in any form. He believes that people should be entrusted and empowered, that given the opportunity, released from the chains of authority and the spell of a corrupting media, we will form fair and functioning systems, that they may not be perfect, but remember, we're not competing with perfection, we're competing with corruption, inequality and destruction. I asked him if we could formulate a centralised revolutionary movement to coordinate transition. He said this, the anarchist. Well, my own approach is to avoid constituting any sort of new authority because in a revolutionary situation there's crisis and conflict and therefore always an excuse for the provisional authorities, however well-meaning, to amass more and more power, which is a fair point. The Arab Spring, we were all so excited about on Twitter, turned out to be fuck all, as usual. I suppose we could try to ensure that a military junta isn't placed in power at any point. Those guys with uniforms and medals and sunglasses are normally wrong uns. I asked him what he envisaged then, while simultaneously stuffing my beret and mirrored shades down the side of the sofa. My dream, he said, is to create 1,000 autonomous institutions that can gradually take over the business of organising everyday life, pretty much ignoring the authorities until gradually the whole apparatus of state comes to seem silly, unnecessary. A bunch of buffoons, useful for entertainment perhaps, but no one we have to take seriously. Obviously that only works if they don't have the means to shoot you. The tricky thing is that means, much as you hate the cops or the army, you're only going to win if at some point those guys decide that they're just not going to follow orders to shoot you. I like the idea of creating autonomous organisations to perform necessary social functions that are not motivated by profit. This, along with the principles of equality, non-violence and ecological responsibility, are necessary pillars of revolution. I disagree with David's antipathy towards the police and military. This could be for a couple of reasons. Maybe David, as an anarchist, is always in protests like Occupy Wall Street or marches or whatever and gets himself into confrontations with authority. I've done a bit of that myself, not in his league, but I was always getting nicked when I was a junkie, so I've had my fair share of skirmishes with the law. However, I'm fortunate in that I have a very positive feeling towards the police and army. The police that have arrested me have usually been all right, and they've always had a point. I happen to think that all drugs should be legal, and when I was a drug user, I paid no heed to prohibition, but I understand the position of the officers arresting me. Mostly these arrests, futile though they were conducted in a relatively bonhomous and professional manner. Once a copper who pinched me in Soho before searching my marijuana-laden bag announced whilst rolling up the arms of his shirt with a magician's flourish, "Nothing up this sleeve, nothing up this sleeve." I recall too that the chat in the back of the van weren't too bad as they dispatched me to the nick. It'd be less antagonistic perhaps if the police didn't wear police uniforms. It's a crime when someone else does, impersonating a police officer. Maybe the police wouldn't impersonate police officers either. The uniform, a dehumanising device. I've encountered the police in domesticity, stripped of the thin blue line. My mate René Zagger's older brother was a copper and I was struck by his normality. Once I house-sitted with a mate, a copper's flat in South London, and he had hash in his front room. And these days, when I chat to the Met, I see that they're not really any different from me. Normal people from around the estuary, supporting Spurs or the Hammers or Chelsea. An armed response vehicle pulled over in East London, and the policeman driving it, younger than me, said he'd seen me on the telly and that he agreed with me. "Politicians are full of shit," he said. Cases where public disorder has been the offence have been less amicable. When arrested stealing porn in an all-night garage or clambering nude across TV outside broadcast vehicles in the midst of a riot, or even when picked up retrospectively on set for a fray and destruction of public property, there's been a more tangibly adversarial dynamic. It's at an institutional level when acting as the henchmen of the establishment that the police become frightening. As individuals, as humans, we find harmony. Ferguson, Orgreave, Hillsborough, and the many unexplained deaths in custody are all manifestations of the dehumanisation that occurs when an institution that ought to serve the public glitches and becomes a tool for state oppression. The transference of $4.2 billion of US military equipment to local police authorities across America is an indication of what the state regards the role of the police to be. Even Boris is buying up German water cannons to sluice down febrile Londoners. It's as if they know a change is coming. Chapter 9. It's big, but it's not easy. The last time I was arrested was in New Orleans and wasn't that long ago. I was clean. It is worse getting arrested in recovery, and it is worse getting arrested in America. This arrest came during my beard and pyjamas post-marital era. I was making a film called Paradise, don't worry, no one has, with Diablo Cody, the writer of Juno. It was her directorial debut. She's a talented, you know, Oscar-winning writer and a lovely person. I suppose I just wasn't up for making a film. The indicators were clear with hindsight. For example, I was refusing to cut my hair for the part. Or beard. Hair is prissy but understandable. Beard is interdimensional unreasonableness. Diablo and I fashioned my beard together in my trailer as cautiously as you'd sculpt a peace treaty between two nations that prefer war to peace. The reality was my identity outside of filmmaking had become more important to me. I was doing hours of yoga and meditation each day. I was going through a divorce, and the result was a kind of hirsute intransigence. I looked like the cliche of a terrorist, and I behaved like one, except the beard wasn't the symbol, it was the cause. I feel some guilt about my lack of enthusiasm for acting, like it's a bit ungrateful, like I've let my teenage self down. Mind you, he let himself down a fair bit, the dirty little pervert. The dreams of my adolescent self were entangled with silvery screens and limousines, and I still feel that I need to offer up superficial sacrifices to his misguided altar. The fact is, though, I find filmmaking a boring process, and its ends dubious. This could, of course, be due to the quality of the stuff I've done so far, as opposed to an essential rejection of an art form. Maybe if I'd been R.P. McMurphy, or The Elephant Man, or Brian, I'd feel different. It just wasn't what I thought it would be. It's not just the entertainment industry that has seemed like a mirage on arrival. What about clubs and parties? When I'm there, I think, is this it? Is this all there is? Is this what all the fuss is about? This feeling of disillusionment perhaps climaxed around the time of my divorce and the making of this subsequent film. New Orleans, though, is not a city of lackluster superficiality, but one of unique vibrancy. Mark Twain, the thinking man's Colonel Saunders, said, "America is New York, New Orleans and San Francisco. Everywhere else is Cleveland." The city is renowned for its spirit in every sense of the word. Spirit, there is a Creole voodoo ambience. Spirit, the people are plucky, vivacious and strong. Spirit, everyone is pissed all the time. They are proud that there is an incessant festival, a rolling celebration. The architecture in the French Quarter, wrought iron railings, low ceilings, narrow streets and vines, is perkily romantic and gently decadent, like a wink and a hand on your thigh. It must come from the swamp, the land itself unsure if it's a solid or a liquid that could slip right back into the Mississippi and roll on by, so you might as well party. I got arrested there. My mood was strange. Party towns are strange if you don't drink, if you're there working, if you're beginning to think that making films is not for you, if you're starting to consign easy promiscuity in the big easy to the ever-growing pile of defunct distractions. I don't let go without a struggle, though. I didn't with booze or drugs, and I won't with sex or fame. The problem is that as access to spiritual data and practices of various kinds begin to make a difference, it gets harder to go back to sleep. So I was in New Orleans with a girl, and from the outside my life looks like it's supposed to look. She's a model, I'm in a movie, I rent a vintage sports car. Of course there's paparazzi, but in my teenage dream of me there were paparazzi too. They pursue the car through saxophone streets, and I, like a patient stirring mid-procedure as the anaesthetic fades, think more than ever, this just won't do. When you stop or move, they splat you with hostile chumminess. Hey, Russ, who's the girl? They drive like jackals too, scavenging in your tracks at your heels. This looks how it's supposed to look, but it doesn't feel like it's supposed to feel. And then, several thwarted tricks in, the idea kicks in that I am a man and that I can do whatever I want. That I didn't sign a contract to be preyed upon or spied upon or lied about, then sighed about. Oh, I wonder why'd about. It's no surprised about. The car is bloody hard to drive. The lights turn red and so do I. This brain I have sometimes just says to me stuff like, Russell, this is bullshit. These people have got no right to chase you and harass you. Fuck 'em. Get out of the car now and confront them. Then another part of my brain, apparently distinct from the first bit, goes, you know what? You're right. I'm in charge of the body. I'll take care of it. Then whatever's left of me that's not encompassed by those two or three gets up and goes along with it. The girl says something. The girl always says something. I'm up and out the door. I'm in character. I think I've even got a hat on. I'm committed to this now. Whoever I am, this guy in a hat in a street by a car in New Orleans, this hirsute projection of a teenager's dreams, a languid mosaic of years of refusal and years of abusal and years of confusion. At their car door now, iPhone hyenas, window down, corners of mouth up. He says something from the capsule of his car that collides with how I see the world in that moment, that implies that me snatching his brandished phone out of his hand and throwing it is not a possibility. For me, though, it is, so I do. That smashes the pain of conviviality to smithereens. It also smashes the window of the building across the street. It sails through the air, his liberated phone, like a funereal dove, a symbol of my emancipation from press intrusion, and crashes presumptuously through the window of a law firm. The occupants will know their rights, I quickly deduce. The pap gets out of the car, all confounded and flustered, like I'd tipped over the Monopoly board when he'd just secured Park Lane. There's the bit where we both pretend we're willing to have a fight, then the girl or his friend descend and it's broken up. Back in the car, I'm buzzing, which doesn't help my driving. Pap car A and another Papmobile are still following. I check them in my rearview mirror, like a movie. In the end, they chase us to a hotel. I didn't want to lead them back to where I was actually staying. I didn't hear about it for a few days. Then plain-clothed police come and arrest me at the casino where we're filming. Luckily, the stereotype of bad boy actor already exists, so as I'm led off in cuffs, there is an available reference. Such overt dramatic displays make me, in a compensatory demonstration, act all polite and genteel, like Alan Bennett getting pulled, or Prince Edward at Glastonbury. I don't go in for a snarling wild man performance in this instance, but virtually escort the arresting officers through the casino like Jeeves, bowing and tipping my hat. In America, when you're arrested, they cuff your hands behind your back. Usually in the UK, they leave your hands in front. This makes me yearn for the comparative kindness of a British bobby as I'm helped into the back of the squad car, which has barely any legroom. With my American arrests, both of which followed paparazzi altercations, the first in LAX airport where a spat with an intrusive pap who tried for a shot of my then wife's pants was humorously titled by my mate Matt as Liam Gallagher the Musical, there was a jarring record scratch from pre-arrest conviviality to the cuffing. It felt like I was famous right up to the moment my rights were read. The mind is a machine that registers difference. I suppose we become inured to anything if subjected to it for long enough, poverty or extreme privilege. Fame, after a while, seems ordinary. The accumulation of a million easy treats, a license to speak your mind or sulk. It is possible to retreat into a cell of comfort, ceramic stillness. I am grateful for the disruptions that come and remind me of the shallow impermanence of fame as a condition. This is how I feel in retrospect when I reflect on my few hours in the New Orleans Police Department holding pen. It's not how I felt at the time, though. I was freaked out. That place was fucking scary. The process of industrialization has given their justice system an inhuman hum. The strip lights and the strip searches, the efficiency suffocates humanity. I was marched in by the cops, formerly known as Chatty, and routinely dropped onto the conveyor belt of the NOLA Police Department. There are a series of airlock doors, like in a spaceship. A fella behind a thick pane takes your name, someone else takes your belt and shoelaces or anything you could hang yourself with. I'm a man who likes to accessorise, so it took a while. Splayed across the wall, you're patted down more aggressively than in an airport and with less room for innuendo. Across several airlocks in what I deemed to be the main area, I could see a vast purgatory of inmates divided by gender but in uniform, ubiquitous Guantanamo orange suits. I'm going to look awful in that, I thought. As a celebrity, how I loathe the word, but must be grateful for its perks here, I was placed on the other side of the wall-to-wall desk that divided the room, on the side of the police. Whilst my man of the people tag is one I cherish, I must confess to feeling somewhat relieved to be on the carpeted quarter of that room, not the linoleum ghetto where here and there murmurs were exchanged regarding my arrival. Arrests are like STD tests. You can never be 100% confident of the outcome. Even though I knew I'd only been nicked for a trivial offence, the possibility of a damning conclusion seemed plausible given the awful situation I now found myself in. Even though I knew that beyond the sedated orange riot on one side and the podgy baton-wielding authority on the other, there were an invisible army of lawyers, agents and producers making phone calls and pulling favours, I was a bit scared that due to a tantrum and a clerical error, I was about to begin a life sentence among Louisiana's most dangerous and least fortunate. Movies get made these days in cities that offer favourable economic conditions to filmmakers, so at a governmental level there are relationships between studios and politicians which at this point were extremely convenient to me. The other people there being processed across the physical line of the long chest-high barricade and the imperceptible but more imposing line of poverty had none of my circumstantial advantages. Most of them were black, all of them were poor. Any material wealth necessarily accrued through illegal means, as that is the only means available. I ended up sat next to the facility's overworked psychiatrist. He told me that everyone he saw had either addiction issues or mental health issues or both. Sitting quietly in this place, you can feel the energy. There is a weary lack of hope. On either side of the bureau, people are weighed down by conditions. A pre-ploughed and unrewarding habitualised rut like a destructive circuit in a broken brain, neither side free. The captors as trapped and knackered as the people they're processing in this bloodless abattoir. The poor enslaved by desperation. The rich imprisoned by luxury. I'm not suggesting the New Orleans police are rich. I bet their salaries are shit. Only that any system that requires such extremity to be maintained is detrimental to us all. With my coterie of well-placed benefactors, I was soon strolling out of jail and back onto set with a John Wayne walk and a Lil Wayne grin. But for all my bravado and slapdash renditions of a new anecdote, that couple of hours had widened the crack. I'm lucky in that I've been able to be so gently awoken and reminded. A slap round the face rather than a 5-year stretch. Chapter 10. Ich bin ein Monarch. When travelling in impoverished regions in galling luxury, as I have done, you have to undergo some high-wire ethical arithmetic to legitimise your position. If you can't separate yourself from poverty geographically, then you have to do it ideologically. You have to believe inequality is okay. You have to accept the ideas that segregate us from one another and nullify your human instinct for fairness. Another thing Slingerland, the professor of ancient Chinese philosophy, mentioned was humankind's innate expectation of fairness. We have an instinct for it, and instinctively we reject unfairness. He demonstrated this to me with the use of hazelnuts. As we spoke, there were a bowl of them on the table. Russell, he said, scooping up a handful, we humans have an inbuilt tendency towards fairness. If offered an unfair deal, we will want to reject it. If I have a huge bowl of nuts and offer you just one or two, how do you feel? The answer was actually quite complex. Firstly, I dislike hazelnuts, considering them to be the verminous titbits of squirrels. Unless in a whole nut chocolate bar, then I like them. Secondly, they were my fucking hazelnuts anyway. We were in my house. Most pertinently, though, I imagine, to the point that Slingerland was trying to make, I felt that it was an unfair offering when he had so many nuts. I told him so, and he seemed pleased. Like when at school, when you see a teacher think, I'm really getting my point across here. I'm like Robin Williams in Dead Poets Society. Whilst I was thrilled to get a bit of tutorial approval, I was still reeling from the shoddy deal and told the glowing, nutty professor as much. He explained that human beings and even primates have an instinct for fairness, even in situations where this instinct could be seen as detrimental.
You still have more nuts now than before, he chirped,
failing to acknowledge that all nuts, and indeed everything in the entire house, belonged to me. We then watched an amazing clip on YouTube where monkeys in adjacent cages in a university laboratory perform the same task for food. Monkey A does the task and gets a grape. Delicious! Monkey B, who can see Monkey A, performs the same task and is given cucumber. Yuck! Monkey B looks pissed off but eats his cucumber anyway. The experiment is immediately repeated and you can see that Monkey B is agitated when his uptown, up-alphabet neighbour is again given a grape. This time, when he is presented with the cucumber, he's fucking furious. He throws it out of the cage and rattles the bars. I got angry on his behalf and wanted to give the scientist a cucumber in a less amenable orifice. I also felt a bit pissed off with Monkey A, the grape-guzzling little bastard. I've not felt such antipathy towards a primate since that one in Indiana Jones that wore a little waistcoat betrayed Indy. Professor Slingerland explained, between great frothing gobfuls of munched hazelnut, that this inherent sense of fairness we have is found in humans everywhere, but studies show that it's less pronounced in environments where people are exposed to a lot of marketing.
Capitalist consumer culture inures us to unfairness, he said.
That made me angry. When I was in India, a country where wealth and poverty share a disturbing proximity, I felt a discomfort, in spite of being in the exalted position of Monkey A. Exclusive hotels require extensive, in fact, military security. Blokes with guns stand at the entrance. It has only just occurred to me that the word exclusive specifically refers to the excluded, the people who aren't included, the majority who cannot attend. Like, the exclusivity is a good thing.
Sir, if that canopy was not delicious enough, let me assure you that but a mile from here there is a family in a shack eating food they found on the floor.
Well, that's very reassuring, but could you provide a photograph?
As we entered the five-star splendour through the metal detectors past the armed guard, I realised that if this was what was required in order to preserve this degree of privilege, it could not be indefinitely sustained. When you enter into the opulence of these places, you check out of your humanity as you check in. Of course, India is a land subject to much sectarian violence, religiously motivated. My belief is that all conflicts, though, are about resources or territory, and the theological rhetoric merely a garnish to make it more palatable. These devices that maintain division are what my friend Matt Stoller focused on when I asked him what ideas he had that would change the world. I first met Matt in Zuccotti Park, Manhattan, in the middle of the Occupy Wall Street protest in 2011. This corporate square in the middle of the financial district had become a lurid and buoyant shantytown of placards and canvas. I was magnetised down from my Tribeca apartment by a curiosity that will not yield, that will not be sedated by my ego's ongoing acquisitive quest. Among the many stimulating encounters with cockeyed optimists and hardcore anarchists, my meeting with Matt stood out. Matt at that time worked for the government. He understands power. As a policy wonk for a Democratic congressman, his days were spent in the cogs of the lumbering Washington behemoth. He told me that the establishment was afraid of Occupy. They were afraid because typically protests are backed by non-profit organisations themselves accountable to foundations who have boards, who have members, who can be harassed and intimidated. Occupy doesn't work like that. It is a spontaneous, leaderless cooperative, and that makes it harder to squash. Any of you that saw Brand X, my US chat show, will recognise Matt because I kidnapped him from that square and forced him into my life. I did this because I instantly identified him as a peculiar radical. Good old me. I saw that beneath his cherubic, hay-coloured curls and proper job, he detested the system he was trapped in. I suppose as a man who was in Manhattan making a movie and had trotted down to the protest site dressed in joggers lycra, I identified with his quandary. Since then, he has regularly prized apart the clenched and corrupt buttocks of American politics and allowed me to peer inside at its dirty workings. I asked Matt for ideas that would aid the revolution. His response was, as usual, startling and almost proctologically insightful. No more private security for the wealthy and the powerful, he said. I nervously demanded he explain himself. He did thusly. One economist argued in 2005 that roughly one in four Americans are employed to guard, in various forms, the wealth of the rich. So if you want to get rid of rich and poor, get rid of guard labour. This may be one of the many points in the book where you are shouting the word hypocrite as you listen. Don't think I'm unaware of the inevitability of such a charge. I know, I'm rich, I'm famous, I have money, I'm being paid money for this book. I have had private security on and off for years. There is no doubt that I, as much as anyone, have to change. The only thing I can offer you in the face of this legitimate accusation is that change is something I'm good at. I know that change is a necessity. I have had to change to survive. I'd also like to add, by way of mitigation, that I could have just written Bookie Wook Free, not mentioned global inequality, ecological meltdown, or the complicity of the entertainment industry in holding together a capitalist machine that exploits the vast majority of people, and collected my check. When I was poor and complained about inequality, they said I was bitter. Now I'm rich and I complain about inequality, they say I'm a hypocrite. I'm beginning to think they just don't want to talk about inequality. Revolution is change. I believe in change. Personal change, most of all. At this time, however, we must coordinate a massive change. So please, shout hypocrite at an inanimate object if you must, but please don't dismiss the ideas in it. Know too that I am prepared for change, that I have seen what fame and fortune have to offer, and I know it's not the answer. That doesn't diminish these arguments, it enhances them. Of course I have to change as an individual, and part of that will be sharing wealth, though without systemic change, that will be a sweet, futile gesture. Now let's get back to Matt Stoller, banning private security, ensuring that I'll have to have my own fistfights next time I'm leaving the Manchester Apollo. The definition of being rich means having more stuff than other people. In order to have more stuff, you need to protect that stuff with surveillance systems, guards, police, court systems, and so forth. All of those somber-looking men in robes who call themselves judges are just sentinels whose job it is to convince you that this very silly system in which we give Paris Hilton as much as she wants while others go hungry is good and natural and right. This idea is extremely clever and highlights that there is exclusivity even around the use of violence. The state can legitimately use force to impose its will, and increasingly so can the rich. Take away that facility and societies will begin to equalise. If that hotel in India that I went to was stripped of its security, they'd have to address the complex issues that led to them requiring it. Matt continued, these systems can be very expensive. America employs more private security guards than high school teachers. States and countries with high inequality tend to hire proportionately more guard labour. If you've ever spent time in a radically unequal city in South Africa, you'll see that both the rich and the poor live surrounded by private security contractors, barbed wire and electrified fencing. Some people have nice prison cages and others have not so nice ones. But when there's inequality, there's got to be someone making sure, with force, that it stays that way. Matt here metaphorically broaches the notion that the rich too are impeded by inequality, imprisoned in their own way. Much like with my earlier plea for you to bypass the charge of hypocrisy, I now find myself in the unenviable position of urging you, like some weird bizarro Jesus, to take pity on the rich. It's not an easy concept to grasp, and I'm not suggesting it's a priority. Faced with a choice between empathising with the rich and the homeless, by all means, go with the homeless. It is reductive, though, not to acknowledge that all are encompassed by this system, and none of us are free while it endures. I'm not saying it's worse to be one of Bernie Eccleston's kids than Jason, the homeless bloke who lives under the bridge at the end of my street. I'm saying that the two are connected and everyone will benefit from change. I should also point out that empathy, sympathy and love are limitless resources, energies that never deplete, and at this time of dwindling fuels we should cherish and explore these inexhaustible inner resources more than ever. Back to Matt. Companies spend a lot of money protecting their CEOs. Starbucks spent $1.4 million. Oracle spent $4.6 million. One casino empire, the Las Vegas Sands, spent $2.45 million. This money isn't security so much as it's designed to wall these people off from the society they rule so they never have to interact with normal people under circumstances they may.